You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
I'd like to see the manager.
How good to see you again so soon, Mr. Wick. Shall I announce you?
Yes, please.
Any chance that the hotel manager was as excited to see John Wick as we were, Adam?
No way. Clip there from John Wick Chapter 2, which last weekend opened to double the box office of its 2014 predecessor. This week, we make up for skipping Wick the first time around with a review of the original and the sequel, plus thoughts on another black-clad vigilante, the Lego Batman. It's all ahead.
Darkness!
On Film Spotting.
No parents!
If you're a Film Spotting fan, we hope you've also subscribed to the other Film Spotting family of shows. There's been some great movie talk out there now from Film Spotting SVU and The Next Picture Show. SVU features a listener's choice review this week of Swiss Army Man, along with a conversation about other streamable Paul Dano movies for all those, you know, Paul Dano completists among you. And coming next week from The Next Picture Show with Tasha Robinson, Scott Tobias, Keith Phipps, and Genevieve Kosky, a Dark Knight double feature, Burton's 1989 Batman, paired up with the new Lego Batman, and we think they are onto something, as you will hear us discuss a little bit later in the show. For more info or to subscribe to SVU and The Next Picture Show, visit iTunes. It may be mid-February, but is it me, Josh, or does it only just now feel like a new movie year finally?
Well, we got the 2017 calendars into the Film Spotting headquarters offices, so we might as well move forward.
There you go. We've got the Lego Batman. We've got John Wick Chapter 2, the first 2017 films we finally got around to reviewing. Last year, about this time, our first 2016 film to get a review, it was your eventual number one film of the year, Hail Caesar.
That turned out well.
Now, 2015, Michael Mann's Black Hat.
Mm-hmm.
We were decent on
good
that.
Good stuff.
Followed by the Wachowski sisters' Jupiter Ascending. Not so much. Those reviews of John Wick 2 and Lego Batman will come later in the show.
But first, a trip back to 2014 when Keanu Reeves starred in a seemingly forgettable action flick that proved to be anything but.
I lost everything. That dog was a final gift from my dying wife.
Jonathan, you got out once. You dip so much as a pinky back into this pond, you may find something reaching out to pull you back in.
It's personal.
Where'd you get that car?
What does it matter?
It's not what you did, son. It's who you did it to.
The nobody?
That nobody. It's John Wick.
They don't happen that often here on Film Spotting, but every once in a while we get a rare blind cow sighting. This is one of those cases where we're doing a sacred cow review, though, as you'll hear in a minute, even that is up for debate, of a movie, John Wick, that just came out a few years ago, but has achieved already a certain status.
Cult status, for sure.
I think that's fair to say. I've seen it. So I'm revisiting the film, which is usually what we do with Sacred Cows. But Josh, this is blind spotting for you until you were forced by the release of John Wick 2 and the brilliant idea on the part of our producer, Sam Van Hallgren, to talk about both films at once. You had not seen this movie.
And to be clear, I see this as a great opportunity. I wasn't forced. I always felt like I should have seen John Wick, that I missed out. So to be able to work it into the show like this, I was all for it.
So we wanted to set the table a little bit by sharing the results of our recent poll question anticipating this show and wanting to know what the vibe was out there amongst film spotting listeners towards John Wick. We asked you whether or not John Wick is, in fact, a sacred cow, a false idol, or a third option, I guess I should see John Wick. Josh, do you want to share how it came out?
Well, a false idol received 25% of the vote, put it in last place. A sacred cow, 36%.
Not bad.
Of voters went that way, but 39% won. I guess I should see John Wick. Let's hope they're at least interested in listening to this episode. Yeah. I don't know if that bodes well for this show, but maybe this will be a great introduction for them
as
well.
I hope many of them got a chance to see it and they can either nod their heads in agreement as they hear us or want to throw their iPhones on the ground or turn the radio dial immediately. We'll have to get to the feedback as it comes in. But we already have a little bit of feedback in response to this poll, and you'll hear some of the thoughts our listeners have about John Wick in response to this poll question, starting with Brett from Newton, Massachusetts. Is this really what the film spotting cognoscenti are wondering about these days? If it came out less than 3 years ago and it's not really on people's minds, then maybe I have a different understanding of what a sacred cow means in film spotting land.
More concerns here from Jacek. He's from Poland. Guys, are you really going to do this? It's an awful thing to put too much weight on a perfectly fine, charming, and energetic film by giving it 14 Oscar nominations. Oh, sorry, that was another film I was thinking of. But my initial point still stands. John Wick is a special kind of action film, as it is not only perfectly executed by veterans of action filmmaking, but it also maintains a pitch-perfect tone of a deadpan intensity, cranked up just a tad too much. It's unique in that way, and I love it for it, but putting it in the film spotting pantheon seems like a slight exaggeration. So my guess is that, in the spirit of the film, this is a deadpan joke. Still, I voted Sacred Cow, but felt like it's a bit of a stretch.
Okay, so not totally enamored with this notion of John Wick achieving Sacred Cow status, certainly going into the pantheon, but ultimately pro John Wick there from Jacek. And we should note that even though we have talked about over the years the idea of Sacred Cow reviews, if we are both favorable, highly favorable in our responses to those films upon the revisit, then maybe they should, in fact, be bestowed into the film spotting pantheon. We haven't really put that in motion yet at this
point. We haven't. And I think the key phrase is highly favorable. That leaves us a little wiggle room.
There you go.
Let's hear from Jeffrey Post. Wick is a solid action film, but in the end, it's little more than a string of hyper-violent fight scenes in which Keanu Reeves punch shoots people in the head. If you want something of that ilk to consider as a sacred cow, perhaps you should consider The Raid.
We also heard from Greg Gordon, who is perplexed that it's even being considered for such an honor. I understand that the movie has its good qualities, but what is John Wick besides a slightly ridiculous action movie with some great traditional sequences? Don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of it, but are we that deprived of alternative action cinema in an age of superheroism that one outlier has us drooling over that one scene in the club? I don't see what's to worship there, even if people do love the simplistic mayhem of it all. I look forward to hearing where the verdict ends up. You know where I stand.
Two more here. The first from Jonathan Anderson. All of y'all are making John Wick sad. Dude already lost his dog. Ease up.
Seriously.
A little spoiler there,
fair,
I guess. But and Dan Buckler. A good dollar movie is one you see with a group of friends at a second-run theater. It's typically either an action or comedy flick, and you tend to be louder than at a regular movie theater because you know people didn't spend $10 or more on the ticket. John Wick was one of the greatest dollar movies of the last 5 years. Every gunshot, punch, and pre- or post-mortem one-liner created palpable audience energy, and I left feeling like everybody in the theater was my new friend. It is a relentless, efficient film with a tremendous cast of characters, including the great David Patrick Kelly as a crime scene cleaner, and a wonderful mythology. The villains could have been a bit more interesting, but they touted the titular character more than any hype machine has done since Colonel Troutman.
I love it. A nice Rambo reference there from Dan, and Dan is going to come back into the conversation here in a minute as we do officially get to this blind cow discussion of John Wick. It took me almost 6 months to see John Wick following its release in October 2014. The lesson being, of course, that not only am I sometimes bad at judging movies after I've seen them, I'm especially bad at judging movies before I've seen them. Sometimes even before I've seen the trailers, as I usually do avoid them, which I think was the case with Wick. I know it's been a while, Josh, but I don't recall a second thought given by either of us to even catching it in the theater, much less actually reviewing it here on the show. Do you remember why you were maybe ambivalent about this film?
I think we saw it as a slick genre entry and little more, maybe falling along the lines of the Liam Neeson films of late, which I know those also have their fans, Unseen by Me, the Taken ones movies. In particular, and just saw it as part of that trend, maybe, is what I'm thinking.
I've got another title here for you in a second that I skipped, and I believe you did as well. Yeah, in terms of draws, Keanu Reeves, though an actor I respect from My Own Private Idaho and The Matrix, among other films, he wasn't a hook. The slick, excessively violent assassin thing wasn't a hook either. And I'm sure I never consciously made this comparison, especially as I have still only ever seen brief parts of this movie. But my interest level was probably the same for John Wick as it was for the first name that popped into my head this morning when I was trying to come up with a film that seemed generally similar to John Wick, except with no classic status, cult or otherwise. Conveniently, it's another stylized action crime thriller about a revenge-driven badass with a two-syllable name in the title role, Max Payne.
I don't even remember Max Payne.
The 2008 Mark Wahlberg vehicle opened at number one at the box office and earned a respectable $85 million worldwide, but I've never met anyone who urged me to see it or spoke positively about it or spoke about it. Period. As for critics, Max produced a truly painful 16% on the tomato meter out of 132 reviews. John Wick, in contrast, 85%, plus scores of critics and fans excited at the prospect of a sequel. So how did we get here? How is it that with all the Max Paynes out there that have been forced into early retirement, we're giving the sacred cow treatment to a movie directed by two former stuntmen, Chad Stahelski and David Leitch, where the main character dispatches like 250 bad guys in a barrage of bullets and bloodshed, all because one of them killed the dog his dead wife gifted to him so he wouldn't have to mourn alone? Does the answer lie somewhere in what listener Dan Buckler suggested? Its relentlessness, its efficiency, its cast of characters, its wonderful mythology? Or Josh, after failing to review it and failing to even see it until 2.5 years after its release, would you dare give the boogeyman another reason to hunt you down? I don't know if you've heard this, but I once saw him kill three men in a bar with a pencil.
I've heard that story, too.
So tread lightly.
All right, I'll be careful. I'm not too worried because I enjoyed this film. What's the distinction here against countless, you're right, just countless forgettable action stories like this? Well, we could go back to the Ebert maxim of that it's not what it's about, it's how it's about it. I think there's your answer. And to be a little bit more detailed, when it comes to genre films, whether it's something like this, an action revenge drama, or some other familiar genre, horror, something like that, there are craftspeople, and then there are crankers, where they're just cranking the junk out because they know there is an existing audience for it. Clearly, there was an audience for Max Payne. Probably, I'm assuming, a profitable film, maybe, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And so there are filmmakers who will crank that stuff out to get it done, to make the money. And then you see craftspeople, like I think we can put Leitch and Stahelski and Reeves as well in this category, and their collaborators who clearly care for the sort of film they're making. They put effort into every scene. They're not rushing to get through things. Mm-hmm. And you feel the, I don't know if joy is the right word for a movie that's as dark and graphic and violent as this, but you feel that love of craft, I guess, is a way to put it. And so if you're used to seeing a lot of genre films or you just go to see a lot of movies, you're going to recognize that distinction probably about 3 minutes in, you know? Mm-hmm. You're going to see that, okay, they thought about where to put the camera. They thought about how to introduce this character. They thought about taking all of these cliches and giving them just a little bit of shine or showing them from a little different angle and doing something that will make a film gain status that John Wick has. And so I'm completely on board with this is a movie that deserves the reputation it has. sacred cow. Maybe we can have that argument towards the end of this discussion if we want to launch it that far. But yeah, this movie definitely deserves its accolades.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. I agree with everything you said, and I think you encompass well what makes this movie stand out. We heard from Gray and some of those other listeners. They asked what makes everyone worship this film. Well, maybe it is the dearth of other films that are as really well-crafted as this movie is. But for me, I broke it down in three ways. And the first thing that I think elevates this film above so many others like it is what I'm calling as an umbrella term structure. But it actually encompasses three of the things that Dan in his email mentioned. It's the efficiency, it's the cast of characters, and it is the larger mythology that it largely hints at, but gives us these wonderful little tastes of. In terms of that efficiency, it is so simple. This wonderfully streamlined revenge tale where you have a main character. We've seen this guy before so many times, the guy who's done his last job. He's tried to turn his back on a certain life of crime. But in this case, the reason why he turned his back, the wife, she's just being put in the ground as the movie opens. It's not like he's been grieving for 6 months or a year and he's getting pulled back in. The wounds are still very fresh. And then when that dog is killed, he sets out for revenge. And we can buy that. I mean, it's almost in itself a parody of other films like it, just cooked into that concept,
there,
right?
It's on a knife's edge there,
yeah,
of
the whole
turning
time
into parody or even self-parody, and
yes,
they manage that balance.
No, they completely do. And so then when that dog is killed by the son of the Russian mob kingpin, it's very simple. He's going to get his revenge. He's going to kill this punk no matter what it takes. Of course, his father, even though he recognizes that his son did something incredibly stupid and should be punished for it, he's also going to do what he has to do by his own code, and he's going to protect his son. And you kind of see where this is going to go. So I love that everybody's motivations here are so clear and so precise. And I'll also add that when he gets the dog, that's a very emotional scene. And I think a great bit of acting by Reeves, where it sets the stakes for the entire film. There's also something very primal about it. Whether we want to see ourselves in any way, shape, or form like a John Wick type of character, I think we can all tap into first that grief that he's feeling and then that thirst for revenge. Absolutely. I also love that it's so confined. This gets into the mythology a little bit. As far as the locations go, at least with this first film, we're not talking about John Wick 2. We'll get to that later. But as far as locations and key players, and yet the screenwriter, Derek Kolstad, he creates this entire world that we have a sense we've only skimmed the surface of. There's just wonderful intrigue imagining this entire world of the Continental Hotel, where he goes to stay, and this larger network of assassins and their codes and all the rules they live by, and the fact that all these people like this might just be existing under our noses, which is kind of a terrifying thought if it was true, but it is fun to think about a little bit. Other wonderful touches in terms of the screenplay and the structure, the delayed gratification of seeing Wick be the John Wick we've been hearing so much about, and then absolutely it delivers when the time comes for him to finally unleash hell. And efficiency, the best line in this entire film, Josh, might be one word. And it's when the Russian mobster played by Michael Nyquist, Viggo, he hears from John Leguizamo what his son did wrong.
I heard you struck my son.
Yes, sir, I did.
Yeah, may I ask why?
Yeah, well, because he stole John Wick's car, sir, and killed his dog.
All he can say is,
oh.
And it says so much. And then the son repeats that later. The son, I only caught it the second time. The son says, oh, after he hears from his father that he just stole something from the boogeyman.
John Wick doesn't even need that oh.
No.
I mean, it is so concise. And that efficiency is so key. One example I would give of that is we go early on into his garage. And we see that a baseball bat has been launched through the windshield of his wife's SUV that's still sitting there in the garage. That's all. We don't need a scene of him raging out.
No.
I mean, we do get a few teary moments with Reeves, but we don't even really need those because he just walks past the car. The camera doesn't even linger on it. It's in the background. Yep. And we see that he has been so distraught by the loss of his wife that he did something like that.
Yeah.
And in this way, you know, if I had seen John Wick when it first came out, I never would have made that comparison. But seeing it now in this movie season, it's like the inverse of Manchester by the Sea, because there's a guy who's mourning and grieving and he just keeps burying it deeper inside, mm-hmm. right? Casey Affleck's character. Whereas John Wick, he unleashes his mourning on the world.
Yeah.
And the puppy thing sounds silly and people joke about it. But what it does in the context of the film is that any sort of containment he's had for his rage after his wife's death, he might be able to make it. And then when he loses that dog, yeah. which, as you said, is a gift from her, those two things intertwine in his head. And we completely understand why he's going bonkers yes. over this dog.
Yeah.
We're with
all him. The time it takes setting up that dynamic. And as I said, before we even see him be the John Wick that is obviously so legendary and so mythological, we feel like we completely understand
we know him.
His psyche.
Yeah. And as far as the world building you're talking about, I thought for sure I would have bet money that this was a graphic novel adaptation.
Okay. I was going to go
and
there with the style.
And that is because,
yeah. It,
well, yeah, the style, absolutely. But even in terms of the fact that this whole mini universe has been built out so well.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's in the style. And this speaks to what I started with at the top in terms of these being craftspeople. You get a simple shot of him at the grave site, but instead we see it from behind a mystery man in silhouette holding an umbrella.
Yeah.
He blocks off most of the scene. It's mostly darkness because of his silhouette. And then in one corner, far off, we watch as Wick buries his wife. That's something like, you know, what one of the things I love about Sin City, the first Sin City, is the mm-hmm. way it recreates those original graphic novel frames. Here, we're getting that sort of care for composition, but it's completely original, mm-hmm. which was a surprise to me.
Yeah, it was to me as well. Like you, I assume the first time I saw it, and actually up until about a week ago when I Googled it, I assumed that this was based on a graphic novel or even a video game like Max Payne, not to belabor that. But every frame of this film is like a panel. The blacks, the grays, it's often raining. And I picked another shot, actually, and I put it here in my notes because I wanted to look at it while we were talking. But one at the cemetery where now that mystery man who turns out to be Willem Dafoe, a friend of his, someone who's been in the business and who does factor into the story later, he is now shaking hands with him, saying goodbye to him. They have a brief conversation at the gravesite. And if you look at this frame from some of the tombstones in the foreground, trees, them, then more tombstones, and then the skyline, the city in the background, there's like 12 layers of depth to this frame. And the more you look at it, the more you see the tombstones behind them actually look like the city. They look like their own mini skyline in front of them, and you can draw whatever conclusions you want from that. So that's not just that frame, though. That's every frame of this film.
Yeah, yeah, it's consistent.
And so I really appreciated that attention to detail. And then with the action and the fight scenes themselves, the attention that's devoted to the choreography of each sequence, as he usually does. Sam also said this best in his one line, I think, John Wick review when he just revisited it for this show. Sam said, it's like if Damien Chazelle had studied murder in college instead of jazz.
Yeah.
So another La La Land reference here in this John Wick review already, the 14 Oscar nominations, of course, the listener was referring to. But it's not about chaos, which so many action movies are,
mm-hmm.
and the camera moving to capture movement or just move for the sake of moving. It's about the camera staying still enough and giving us a long enough shot. Usually we're watching these characters in full body, long shot from their feet up to their heads. We get to watch them move. We have to watch them move. We have to see John Wick be the killer that he is purported to be. We have to believe that he's capable of everything everyone says he's capable of, or what's the point of any of this? And that priority, and the real priority that's put on the stunt work, not surprisingly, coming from two former stuntmen, that being authentic, not CGI magic, it does make this movie special.
There's precision to each of those scenes, mm-hmm. and we're never confused. And we get so many action movies where confusion and chaos, as you said, is mistaken for things being thrilling.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you just jostle the audience, then you're supposedly entertaining them. And that's not the case. It's my biggest complaint about Michael Bay's movies, vast majority of them. And here we always know where the opponents are. the results of their particular moves. It's key, I think, that they're borrowing the gun-fu style that's mostly attributed to John Woo a lot of times. And that brings with it a certain, you know, I tire personally from gunfights. I'm just getting worn out by them in general. But here, every bullet counts. And that's really saying something because they go through a lot of bullets, but we see the effect of almost each one. We understand why each shot was fired. As a matter of fact, there are a few times where John Wick will fire and he didn't really need to. And it jumped out at me like, oh, I'm surprised he wasted that bullet.
Yeah.
because otherwise they're paying such close attention to all those elements. And that goes for, you know, the hand-to-hand combat as well. So yeah, that stuff maybe we expected that to experienced stuntmen would bring to a film. But it's absolutely one of its qualities and speaks to the precision that the movie has overall.
Another one of those great qualities, another one of the elements that I singled out about John Wick is Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
He's one of those actors that over the years, of course, it can be easy to kind of malign him or joke about him being the character from Bill and Ted, or even you go back to Point Break, and there are some lines that now, or even at the time, actually scanned pretty comically, whether they were meant to be or not.
I am an FBI agent!
But as I said, whether it's from The Matrix, or My Own Private Idaho, or even appearing in a little movie like Thumbsucker, and recently in The Neon Demon. He's fantastic in that film in a much smaller role. I've definitely come to appreciate him as an actor. But now because of John Wick, mainly John Wick the first one, not maybe so much Chapter 2, I am much more interested in seeing whatever comes next from Keanu Reeves. And someone who really broke this down well, maybe better than anybody ever has, is someone who was a guest host here on the show, last summer?
Yeah,
talk about
summer.
Suicide Squad with you, Angelica Jade Bastien. She wrote a great article for the magazine Bright Wall, Dark Room that then RogerEbert.com excerpted. We'll link to it in our show notes. I think we've already mentioned this article once or twice here over the past few months, but she talks about Keanu as a great silent film type of actor, a great screen presence who communicates everything physically. And I agree with that. A simple glance, she writes, or curled lip can unfurl lengthy character history or upend expectations. And then what she says about his less successful performances, I think, is really instructive as well. The failed performances are those that push him toward a theatricality against his natural instincts. They also tend to be the kind of roles actors use to challenge or prove themselves. Difficult accents, lush period pieces, reliance on verbal dexterity. Yes, in Dracula, Keanu is overburdened by the period costumes, lost in the details of each frame as if he were another illusion, appearing as though he's wandered onto the wrong set. This isn't because he's out of his depth. It's because he's fighting against his natural instincts as an actor. Well, that sounds very similar to an argument I've made over the years about another actor who I think can be very good in certain types of roles. And when he fails, it's because he's being pushed into roles that require a certain theatricality and roles that fight against his natural instincts. And that's Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was actually trying to envision how Brad Pitt might play John Wick and how, maybe this isn't fair, it's all in my head anyway, but how I don't think he could pull it off the way Keanu Reeves does. And one of the reasons why I say that is because I think about how still Keanu truly is in this film and how easy it seems to be for him to just exist on screen. And when people are talking about him, when they're repeating back to him the things about his exploits as a hitman and how he's the boogeyman, he betrays nothing. He betrays nothing in those moments. And Brad Pitt's the type of actor who he can just be busy enough that I don't think he could do that. Bruce Willis is another guy who can be that still on screen. Brad Pitt would need to find some way to express the character's reaction to what the other characters on the screen are saying. And Keanu Reeves can just, he can just be in it. He can just be in the moment in a way that I think is really striking.
Yeah, and what that's mistaken for a lot with Reeves, I think, is an emptiness. Because it is anti-theatricality, as Angelica points out. And he leaves it for the audience to fill in what maybe other actors would do themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think when he's in a movie like Coppola's Dracula, then it gets filled in by the production design or the costuming or, and this is particularly why I think we associate bad dialogue maybe with Reeves, is because that emptiness gets filled in by laughable lines. And when they become the forefront, it seems like that's all he's giving. But it was interesting to watch John Wick and get a better handle on what Reeves' presence exactly is, because here it is a silent movie performance in a sense that it's all about his movement and how Wick moves and the purposefulness of it. And this isn't to say that he's an unstoppable killing machine. One of the things I liked very much was the fact that he would have labored breathing after these fight scenes.
He's not in the greatest shape.
Well, you get that. You know, you really feel that he's been out of work. Mm-hmm. And he gets wounded, and the wounds last, and they don't heal immediately. And so that's all part of the characterization as well. So I do think, you know, for a movie that's really built around really attempting to build this mythical figure that is the boogeyman, Reeves manages to inhabit that and give just enough humanity, the touches at the very beginning of the film that we were talking about, to give a full-fledged performance. Now, is it actorly? No, not at all. But it's exactly what this movie needs.
Yeah, it's exactly what it needs. And it goes back to the primal elements of this film. There is something elemental, basic in the best way, almost zen, even if he's in turmoil and not feeling any sort of inner peace whatsoever. I think that's crucial to this character, because he's a character who is caught between two worlds. He's caught between literal worlds and also metaphysical ones. And I go back to a performance like My Own Private Idaho, where it's very different, of course, but in some ways it's very similar. He plays Scott the Hustler, whether he's playing that male prostitute character or he's playing, by the end of the film, Scott, the future heir to the throne. He is able to allow the audience to impose onto him our feelings about him, our fears, our desires, our anger, whatever it might be. He allows us in a way that, to your point, I think a lot of other actors would feel compelled to hand it to us as opposed to allowing us to do that work.
Vigo. When Ellen died, I lost everything. Until that dog arrived on my doorstep. A final gift from my wife. In that moment, I received some semblance of hope. An opportunity to grieve unalone. And your son took that from me. Stole that from me. Kill that from me! People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
So all of this being said, I don't know if I can go sacred cow, though, on this. I mean, I could put John Wick alongside other similar supremely crafted action films that I've liked, like Jason Statham's Transporter. Mm-hmm. That's one that I remember having a similar response to, like, whoa, something different is being done here. A couple of the Fast and Furious films I would put on a similar level. I think it's about maybe 15 minutes too long, as streamlined as it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't need that extra sequence. So maybe that's what's holding me back.
You're right. I actually completely agree with that. I think it's more pronounced because the structure is so efficient. Everything has been so streamlined up to a certain point. And so when it deviates from that, when some of the character motivations aren't entirely clear, then you really do notice it. I think that Willem Dafoe's role in the movie is, when you think about it, I know the whole movie's kind of silly, but it's really silly. Like, even within the context of this film, where I don't think it's a spoiler to say that he helps John Wick out a little bit, and you think about what his role in the movie is, we're supposed to believe that he basically just hangs out on rooftops all day and night waiting for John Wick to get into trouble, which seems a little bit unrealistic. But this bad guy, even, he has the ability to kill John Wick. The whole movie, he's been all about business, recognizing the threat. We got to take care of it. We got to neutralize it. We know what he's capable of. He's the boogeyman. He's the one who tells us that, right? And then what does he do? It turns into a James Bond sequence where they tie him up and he leaves the room and waits for someone else to do it. It's a little bit ridiculous. And so even by the end of the film, then what ends up motivating John Wick after he has more or less completed his mission to go off on one more mission? That's where the motivations become muddy, and some of the satisfaction does start to wane a little bit.
It just starts to betray its own purity. So
it does. It does. But for me, I guess I have to think about more what I believe a sacred cow to be. I agree with a portion of our listeners who think that the name Sacred Cow just probably shouldn't apply to a movie that has only been around for 2.5 years, because these are films that are supposed to be movies that we saw maybe years ago and are hailed as classics. And
yeah,
we're revisiting
the time,
to
right.
see if they really do still hold up. We can't do that with John Wick. In terms of its greatness, if you will, I may be more inclined to say it belongs on a list of some of those other titles that we've done Sacred Cow reviews of. I'm not ready to put it in the pantheon with, let's say, my 50 favorite movies of all time.
Okay, well, what's an action movie that is Sacred Cow pantheon level? Like, what are we talking about
Raiders
here? If it's not
Lost
Transporter,
Ark.
Raiders of Lost Ark, Die Hard. So, yeah, I mean, now you're starting to talk about
sure.
some pretty good stuff.
But I wonder if 10 years from now, 15 years from now, it's already starting. Perhaps a lot of us will think of John Wick the same way we think about Die Hard.
We'll see.
We will see. John Wick is available to rent on most platforms, including pay-per-view, if you happen to be staying at a hotel with a bunch of other assassins, perhaps. If you've seen it, and we've already heard from some of you, and you agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Like John Wick, Adam and I need to pause and tend to our wounds before jumping back into the fray. We'll get to John Wick Chapter 2 later in the show. Up next, some brief thoughts on the Lego Batman movie. Stay with us.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You need to face reality.
What do you mean, reality? Do you have any idea what it's like knowing my real brother and mother spend every day of their lives looking for me? Huh? How every day my real brother screams my name.
Oscar nominee Dev Patel with Rooney Mara in the Best Picture nominated film Lion. Lion also the recipient of 4 other Oscar nominations. Josh, this is a film that you have seen. I have still been derelict in my Oscar preparation duties and haven't seen it. Talked about it just briefly in what we call our hot mic segment, which we just tag on to the end of our podcasts, some of them anyway, as we're warming up for the show. You were a fan of this movie.
Yeah, I'd encourage people who were maybe hesitant as I was to check it out. Maybe seems a bit of an oddball among the other Oscar Best Picture nominees, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. Dev Patel is fine in the role. There are probably more than a few other performances from last year that I would put up there as the best 5. And maybe when we get to talking and previewing the Oscars, we can name some of those that we really appreciated from the last year. But yeah, don't sleep online. It's worth seeing.
The Oscars are next weekend, and on next week's show, as Josh alluded to, we'll share our Oscar picks, who will win, who should win, and who should have been nominated in the first place. We do as well have some movie passes to give away here, Josh, and very excited about this film, very excited to give away some passes to it. Personal Shopper, it's the latest effort from the great director Olivier Assayas. He previously worked with the star of this film, Kristen Stewart, on Clouds of Sils Maria, which was one of my favorite films of 2015, and she's gotten a lot of acclaim for her performance in this film that came out, I didn't look this up, and so that means I'm going to be wrong, but I feel like it played probably at Cannes 2016. It's been out for a long time.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just now getting a theatrical release here in the States in 2017. It opens March 17th. In fact, we have passes, though, for a Tuesday, March 7th screening, and all the information you need, including how to enter to win those passes, is available at filmspotting.net. So we talked about the Oscars a little bit. Full disclosure, hey, best of luck to all the nominees. I don't really care. I'm probably not even going to watch. That's my annual Oscars tradition.
But it's not an active boycott. You just usually have better things to do.
Well, better things, or I just feel really uncomfortable watching award shows. One of the two. Something I do care about, Film Spotting Madness.
Yes, deeply.
I care deeply about Film Spotting Madness. It's coming. If you are not familiar with the wonder, the joy, the
pain.
The pain, the constant arguments behind the scenes of Film Spotting Madness.
Well, and this the pain of having to make choices.
Make choices. Once,
that's what I was referring to. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't either, because that's my favorite part of Film Spotting Madness is all the talking. But this is the third annual Film Spotting Madness. In 2015, we filled the brackets with 32 of our favorite actors. The title match, Michael Fassbender versus Jessica Chastain. Fassbender did come out on top. Last year, we did a director's bracket. Many anticipated an all Anderson final. PTA versus Wes.
Mm-hmm.
My guy PTA versus your guy Wes. It could have been so perfect.
That would have been great.
In fact, the Coen brothers, who we both love, kind of ran the field. They beat Paul Thomas Anderson in the final 62-38. I looked that up. They really did kind of trounce Paul Thomas Anderson there. And then it was Martin Scorsese versus Wes Anderson in the consolation bracket. And I don't know if you remember this. Do you remember how that one came out, Scorsese versus Wes?
I'm going to guess Wes won that.
No, it was 50-50. Like, Scorsese won it by one or two votes.
Oh, wow.
That's it. But
okay.
It was basically 50-50.
How do these look now a few years off? I mean, I think the Fassbender choice was probably the right one, looking at the films they've made since. It's still a little soon to really say.
Maybe so. I think the directors, really, we would look back on from last year and think it's hard to argue with those final four in terms of those great filmmakers. This year, we're going to turn our attention to the Film Spotting Pantheon. And this is all going to come up in about a month here on the show, as we're going to tie the beginning of Film Spotting Madness, the Pantheon edition, into the show's 12th anniversary. The first week of March does mark 12 years of doing this show. The Pantheon started as a group of films that our producer, Sam, my then co-host and co-founder of the show, Sam, decided to set aside. They were some of our most treasured favorites. They were the ones that just came to mind kind of immediately when we were sketching out what the show was going to be and looking at our top five lists and thinking, what are the movies that we love so much? They're our favorites, but they're also revered. And we know that if we're left to our own devices and we're picking candidates for just about any top five list, we're going to keep gravitating to these titles. And it's going to get really boring for everybody.
So what do we set aside? A few of those original titles that went in?
Of course, Citizen Kane went in.
Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz.
Raiders of the Lost Ark,
later.
Probably.
No, Raiders of Ark was later. But The Godfather Part II.
Sure.
Annie Hall was in there. Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back were in there. Cool Hand Luke was in there. And then as we went through, there were some other more idiosyncratic choices, like In America and Midnight Run, probably the most oddball choice in the Film Spotting Pantheon, but one from our childhoods that we adored and watched constantly. So we've got all the films that are in the Film Spotting Pantheon currently. It's 40 of them. We have, I think, 17 movies that we've given the Sacred Cow treatment to. We're going to include those in the Pantheon discussion. And then we've got another plan that we'll talk about in future episodes to round out the field of 64. We'll probably go with 65, actually, just as the NCAA does. We'll have a play-in bracket here in Film Spotting Madness.
And I still think it's something of a miracle that by the time I joined the show in 2012, We looked at that list of Pantheon films, and it was, what, about 25 at that point?
Yeah, maybe close
something
to 30.
Like that, 30. And I was in agreement on every single one.
I remember you had already joined the show. You were in.
It was too late.
A couple shows we already had under our belts, and I remember sitting there looking at the computer with you one night as we were taping and saying, you know, we probably should look at the Pantheon and see if, because we'd already had.
Give me a litmus test.
We knew we disagreed on some movies, and I was like, yeah, is this going to work? What if he hates some of these films? And we went right down the line. You're like, yeah, no, those are all good.
Yeah.
Those are all really good.
Now,
so, and here you are.
Will that be able to continue as we keep adding them to the pantheon? That's one of those rules we have to talk about.
Yeah.
Do we both have to really like
have
one?
To love it?
Can we just be like, yeah, it's all right. We'll see.
We will see. We'll announce the full bracket with a special Madness Selection show in a couple of weeks to whet your appetite. Until then, here's this week's poll question. Which 2017 Film Spotting Madness film featuring a famous movie couple is best poised to play the Cinderella role in this year's tournament?
Choices are Before Sunset. That one is in the pantheon. Jesse and Celine, the couple there, of course. Groundhog Day was a 2014 Sacred Cow review. Phil and Rita are the couple in Groundhog Day. And then Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Was this an original Pantheon film?
Or I don't think it was. I feel like that was one we added maybe even after you joined the show, Josh.
No,
okay,
I think it was on there. So much history here. Mm-hmm. So much confusing history. Anyway, Joel and Clementine are that film's couple. And then the Royal Tenenbaums. This is the most recent edition. I was on board for this one just last year. Sam sat in for that review. Did he approve of Sacred Cow status? Remember,
listen.
He was kind of poo-pooing the Royal Tenenbaums. Margot and Richie are the couple
he
we're thinking of there.
Yeah, he didn't fight us on it. And to be fair, we are thinking of the movies here, not the couples. That's not what Film Spotting Madness
is about. That's what you should vote on.
You should vote on the movie, but maybe the movie couple is a big reason why you love that particular film.
And this poll question, it reminds me of one of my favorite things about the first Film Spotting Madness, the way Bill Murray almost ran the table.
He did. He did. He
really
was your guy.
Really worried you guys for a while there. So who's going to be this year's Bill Murray, the Cinderella for this Film Spotting Madness? Which one of these films? Go ahead and vote at filmspotting.net. And if you leave a comment along with your vote, we do hope you leave a comment. Also, let us know where you're listening from.
Just looked it up over at Letterboxd. We do have a list of the Pantheon titles. We'll link to them in the show notes. If you're not familiar with where to find it, Eternal Sunshine added August 2010.
Oh, so it 4 to 5 years into the show's history.
It might have been part of actually when we were looking at the best films of the decade. Part of
that
the 2000s, and Eternal Sunshine fared pretty well on those lists, and eventually it did then get added to the Pantheon.
One of my favorite films ever, and I've never been able to put it on a top five list because it was in there before I came.
Poor Josh.
I hate the Pantheon.
What? It's the Batcave! Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Batman! Whoa!
You're darn right, whoa.
Wait, does Batman live in Bruce Wayne's basement?
No, Bruce Wayne lives in Batman's attic.
We can have sleepovers every night.
No, we can't.
Whoa, look at
Will Arnett's Batman with Michael Cera in a clip from the Lego Batman movie. Josh, if I remember correctly, the Lego movie from 2014 was your number one film of that year. Highly acclaimed. I was a fan of it as well, if not quite as big of a fan of it as you were. And not a surprise that we are getting a sequel after the hit that movie was. Now, this one, maybe not quite as meta or self-aware, not quite as self-aware as the Lego movie, but did you find similar pleasures in it?
Oh, yeah, because the humor is very much in the same vein. Mm-hmm. And the self-awareness has a lot to do with that. The rapid-fire jokes, the pop cultural references, all that stuff is here and not tired, I would argue. Mm-hmm. They're not hitting the same beats or the same gags. They're finding fresh humor in this. Yes, it doesn't have the layers of the Lego movie that are really the reason I enjoyed it as much as I did. But boy, was this fun. And, you know, Batman has probably, when I was a kid, Spider-Man was my favorite superhero.
Me too.
As I've gotten older, it's become Batman. But it strikes me that the Batman films,
it's because you're so dark and brooding.
Yeah, it is. That's probably what it is. The Batman films, as much as I've liked many of them, he's often the least interesting character in them.
Yeah.
The performances are the least interesting elements of the movies. Okay, but the character is always so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And the Lego Batman movie is the first one since Michael Keaton's Batman where he's maybe the best thing about it, you know, and it's the way they're taking these tropes from the legend that he lost his parents, that he's inherited this vast fortune, and now he has this alter ego, and twisted that to present a guy who's pompous and happy to be alone. At least he pretends to be happy being alone. And for us to get to watch him in that lifestyle is at once sad and quite funny. I had both emotions early on when he comes home from a night of Joker battling and Alfred's left the lobster thermidor for him. He goes into his vast kitchen, pops it into a little microwave, just stands there, and he's twiddling his bat thumbs waiting for, you know, and he's
and
he's
we wait not, with him.
We wait with him. And, you know, I love that sort of humor in general. But yeah, it's there's character there. There's so much. It's not just a joke. There's also so much character building in that little moment that this little plastic figurine gives us more. And Will Arnett's performance, vocal performance, has a lot to do with that.
It does.
Gives us more than, you know, Christian Bale, who's fine. And I don't know. Would you say Val Kilmer and George Clooney are fine or a little below
I don't know.
Fine?
I never watched those films.
I mean, you know, this is the territory we're getting into. So, yeah, I enjoyed this quite a bit.
Yeah, no, that's a great take on this film. And I took the entire family. I'm guessing you took the kids as well.
Yeah. Addie was busy. We went with B, so we had fun.
Well, yeah, took all four and Sarah as well. And we all laughed our way through this film and had a wonderful time. Of course, my kids, who are all huge nerds and are, of course, as at least one of your children are, big Doctor Who nerds. Oh, the reference to
great jab at Doctor Who.
Great Doctor Who jab and exterminate and the Daleks. And of course, my kids, just their faces lit up. But that's a great point about Bruce Wayne here. And it does make me think about the Batman film from 89, Tim Burton's, which was a sacred cow review here on the show. So, of course, it is part of Film Spotting Madness, or will be part of it here coming up. But one of the things we talked about was just how unhinged that Michael Keaton character is, how it really does, more than the other Batman films, delve into his psyche and his loneliness. And that obviously does come through here. There are some great parallels, as you said, in those scenes of him being at home by himself and the Michael Keaton character being at home by himself. You mentioned there aren't maybe the layers here that there were to the Lego movie, but I'm not sure how many of those layers really came through. Maybe some thematic layers, but in terms of the movie really kind of blowing your mind, that doesn't really happen till the end of the film. And this one, I feel like, along with all the laughs, and you said it, being really moved by it, I found myself at the end of this film just looking at a simple picture, having a quiet moment between some characters that you know is really meaningful for them. There were a couple times where I'm sitting there going, is it getting dusty here in the theater? This is the Lego Batman movie. What is happening? But the characters are that well-defined. And we spent a whole bunch of time during the John Wick segment talking about how clear the characters' motivations are. And that's one of the real strengths of the movie. I think that's one of the strengths of this movie, too. You understand what every character is after and what they're trying to protect, what's important to them. And so when characters make certain decisions at the end of the film or near the end, whether they are the right decision or not, you understand why they did it. They don't need to explain it to anyone else. We as viewers get it.
Yeah, it is funny how we can relate to these, you know, CGI creations, but they very much look like plastic toys. And I think it's the use of the animation for the facial expressions. Mm-hmm. Like, so much care is taken. There's that little, it's not really a montage, but it feels like it, of the Joker being insulted early on. And then just the painted expression changes ever so slightly to show him getting sadder and sadder.
Right.
And that too is, you know, very funny, of course, but also moving, I suppose, in its own way. I think they lay on the lessons a little more thickly here, you know, the Lego movie felt like all of my favorite children's movies do, where they're made for the parents, really, and the kids get to come along.
Yeah, but this one, still that lesson about being creative and being yourself.
Yeah. The live-action framing device, for sure. But here, it starts to get away from the gags and more into the, if Bruce Wayne would learn to cooperate with Michael Cera's Robin and with Rosario Dawson's Barbara Gordon, the new police commissioner, you know, then everything will be all right. It's kind of like, we get it.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel like a lesson to me, like they're trying to teach the kids how to behave. It's about there being the proper resolution to that character.
Right. And it's just that they hit on that so many times that it started to drag a little bit maybe in the final third. But when that was happening, I was almost okay with it, because if I knew what they were going for narratively and thematically, I could just sit back and soak up, I guess, is production design the right word to use for an animated film like this? They pay so much attention to the background details of these scenes.
Yeah, the opening sequence where they rip off The Dark Knight Rises, the beginning of that film, and Bane, here it's the Joker, but taking over a plane.
Yes. Oh,
they almost recreate it. The animation there is incredible.
It's amazing.
I found myself looking at this totally constructed animated world, feeling the same way I felt about it, almost a little airsick. Like you're looking down at the ground, you're on top of an airplane as it's turning. I don't know how they managed to completely give you that same sense.
Well, they're
with,
moving
with Lego blocks.
They're moving the camera too, or at least recreating that effect of moving the camera.
Yeah.
And so that does some of it. But you know, even these spaces like Wayne's mansion with the enormous fireplaces, and you can see that each flame is made to look like it's an individual Lego.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what the Lego Batman movie understands that its predecessor did is that by fully embracing the restrictions of using these geometric building blocks, you're really going to force yourself to become more creative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can seem like it's limiting, that everything's got to look like someone could have made it out of Legos. But somehow they've taken that as it just leads to this wild abandon of let's just build more and more and more. Even the choice to make Wayne Island, you know, Wayne Mansion is now on this island.
Right.
It's just like they're setting another
hurdle.
Because
he's on a literal and metaphorical
yes,
one.
Yes,
yeah.
A hurdle for themselves creatively. And it's thrilling to watch them jump over it in these amazing animations.
It's really funny. That's the best thing I could say about it, too. It's really, really funny. I think my favorite sequence is when he gets dressed up. We finally see him as Bruce Wayne, and he goes to this big gala where they're anointing Barbara Gordon as the new commissioner. And his reactions to everything she's saying and everything people are saying about her are hilarious. But even just the video, they have the montage that's the explanation basically for why Barbara Gordon's so great and also be such a great commissioner. And they're like, she solved crime in our neighboring town through the use of statistics and compassion. It's
very
really
smart.
Funny.
It's so smart. So yeah, definitely. What's a bigger surprise, that you heard a movie was going to be made about Legos and it turned out to be good, or that then
it's done it
sequel
twice. I know. I thought about
really
that during
too.
The film, that they've done this now twice with something that we all shook our heads and said,
right,
I can't believe they're making a Lego movie.
That said, there was the Ninjago trailer beforehand, and it's kind of like, okay, I don't know how long this can go on, but we can hope.
We can. The Lego Batman movie is currently out in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
You do know what the Lego Batman movie needed more of, though, Adam? Gunshots to the head.
Yeah.
Our review of John Wick Chapter 2 when we come back. Stay with us.
I think really the point of this segment is apparently to have Sam make me look really stupid as I try to pronounce words that I have no idea how to pronounce. Our featured musical artist this week is Tanarawen. It's a group of Tuareg musicians that have been playing together since the late 70s. Their latest album from Anti Records is called Elwan. They're currently touring Europe, but they are going to make it to Chicago to play the Old Town School of Folk Music on Tuesday, April 11th, if you like what you hear.
Pretty good, but Europe is actually pronounced Europe.
I tried. I did the best I could. We want to thank a new donor from Beijing, Yuan, and Jeff, and talk about words to mispronounce. Is it Carmel, Indiana, or Carmel, Indiana? I don't know.
Carmel. No,
Carmel?
That's California.
That's California. Wasn't Eastwood the mayor?
Yes,
I'm going to say
was.
It's Carmel, Indiana.
Jeff says, just a note to say I love the show, but more importantly, to go on record that I share Adam's complete dismay and am still stewing over the Sing Street Oscar snub of 2017.
Yeah.
Drive It Like You Stole It, Up, Beautiful Sea, Brown Shoes, all worthy contenders and a winner in there somewhere for best song. You've got the golden brick for beloved movies you championed that are worthy to be seen by more people. How about the silver street or something for movies that, to paraphrase Jerry Reed, deserve the Oscar gold mine but only get the shaft? Those movies that, in spite of your dogged championing, still get overlooked by the establishment. I'm looking at you, Larson. Well, you know, what's funnier than that I'm the establishment or that Sing Street is some sort of renegade movie?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Larson, I'm looking at you, too. And speaking of mispronouncing city names, following up last week, San Luis Obispo.
Oh, good.
We got corrected.
Okay.
San Luis.
Well, now we know.
Expo. Now we know. A new gold level donation comes to us from Jason EGGE. I had dinner with him. I had beers with him the other night in Iowa City, and I never actually got how to pronounce his last name. I'm going to say Egg? Eggy? Eggy. Let's go with Eggy.
Jason Eggy,
yeah,
says,
gold level donor.
The topic of music's effect on a film came up at the meetup. I regret I didn't mention Filmstruck had a great ongoing series entitled Observations in Film Art on the Criterion Channel. I recommend all the episodes and the intro mini documentary, but the first is an analysis of musical motifs in Foreign Correspondent.
Sounds great.
Thank you for creating and nurturing a long-distance film community, Original Recipe, SVU, and Next Picture Show, which encourages me to take in as much film and art as possible. It truly does inspire me to try to see everything available on each of your mid-year top five and year-end top 10 lists before the episode airs. After nearly 10 years of listening, it's time for me to become an ongoing contributor. Thanks again. P.S. I've never written or called into a program before in my life, so take that for what it is.
We will. Take that as a very nice compliment, and we appreciate the donation, Jason. Okay. So to close here, as this segment has been dominated by syntax and talking about mispronouncing certain words, getting things wrong, and our listeners mocking us, Josh, we recently received this email. It comes to us syntactically from John in Robin, Texas. He says, I love your show. It got me through 5 years of school and work commuting. You introduced me to some of my favorite movies, exposed me to new ways of seeing films I already liked or were totally and completely wrong. One place you weren't wrong is A Whole Nother. A Whole Nother is an example of timesis, where one word is cut and a whole nother word is spliced in. Most occurrences of timesis are phrases or profanities, but they are abso-freaking-lutely proper grammar. Clearly, another is often insufficiently emphasized and needs a little zest. Famous examples, Josh, include
fan-bloody-tastic and abso-bloomin-lutely from Pygmalion. How heinous ever it be, that's from Richard II. This is not Romeo, he's some otherwhere from Romeo and Juliet.
And that's really from Romeo and Juliet. Just for the record, this is not Romeo, he's some otherwhere. I had to look that up.
Not making this up. The last one, Some Bloody Wear. Take a Girl Like You by Kingsley Amis is
so,
where that's from.
So we're all in.
Do you know you dropped
one of
these?
Without shame.
I think you dropped one of these. I forget which John Wick conversation. It's either the one we had or the one to come. But I don't know if you went a full whole nother.
I thought I just said another level.
You didn't do a whole nother level?
I don't think I did.
Okay.
But I probably did. Thank you to John and everyone else who donated or just sent us a funny comment this past week. A no-cost way you can help the show, rate or review us on iTunes. We thank SteelerGuy736 and Nathan in Colorado who posted quick reviews this past couple of weeks.
He's offered $7 million for your life. $7 million is a lot of money, Mr.
So I guess you have a choice. You want a war? Or do you want to just give me a gun?
Somebody please get this man a gun.
Keanu Reeves reuniting with fellow Matrix alum Lawrence Fishburne in that clip from John Wick Chapter 2. Adam, I'm just going to jump right in with one of the things I didn't like about John Wick Chapter 2. Lawrence Fishburne.
Really?
I always love seeing him on screen because I think he just has such a unique presence. But man, was he chewing scenery, which is okay.
I thought it worked.
He's done that before.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed that.
The kingpin of the homeless in New York.
If you're going to chew scenery, speed it up a little bit, okay? He was dragging these scenes out so long. Otherwise, I had fun at John Wick Chapter 2. Maybe not quite as much fun as I did finally seeing John Wick. But how about you? A disappointment for you?
Yeah. I mean, I said that John Wick, the first film, could be at least in a conversation about whatever it means to be a sacred cow, if not a film spotting pantheon film. This one would not come anywhere close to it. Josh, I was really disappointed with John Wick Chapter 2. And it's funny because I remember last week on the show, you made the joke about my insistence, my personal preference and how I make fun of you for seeing movies before, seeing the new movie before I go back to the original film, like in the case of a remake, just like I don't want to read the book before I see the movie. And you're all about, well, it came first, so I'm going to see it. And you joked with me, am I allowed to see John Wick before I see Chapter 2? And I said I would allow it. Of course, that makes sense with a sequel situation. It's not a remake. But I almost said last week, that's fine. But you know what? I've already seen John Wick. And because I've seen it, I'm going to wait until after I've seen Chapter 2 to rewatch the first one, because I didn't want the first one so fresh in my mind. And then I'd be in a position where I can't help it. I'm constantly comparing it, especially if I really like the movie. I'm definitely going to be doing that. And maybe it doesn't live up. In retrospect, I wish I had held to that and not rewatched John Wick before I saw Chapter 2, because it doesn't stack up against that film at all for me. And we'll get into some of the reasons why. I'll start at the beginning, though. The beginning of this film, everything post the opening few minutes, which are a chase, and we don't even know completely who's involved or why.
The motorcycle chase.
And I don't know that we're even sure yet how it factors into the film as a whole. But where we meet John Wick again, and where we meet some of the characters from this world, and they're setting the whole story up. Peter Stormare plays now the Russian mobster. He's the Russian mobster from the first film's brother.
Yes.
Less sophisticated, less cultured brother. Everything about
less subdued
this sequence,
in his performance as well.
Oh my. Is really terrible. I mean, I really hated almost every aspect of that sequence. And I'm wondering, we talked about with John Wick that the parody aspect of the film is built into the structure. It's built into every fabric of John Wick. You don't have to do anything to heighten it at all. And there you have Peter Stormare. You talk about chewing scenery. Is he doing a parody of the slimy Russian mobster character we've seen in every other action movie? It doesn't need to be there. And it's really hard to watch. Everything that comes out of his mouth is really hard to watch.
Agreed. But, and I was really dismayed when it was going in that direction and thought, oh my goodness, they have completely botched this by trying to recreate everything, but doing it far less well. The fact that, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it's the first few minutes of the movie, he's gone after that makes me think that is the joke. Like they're basically pulling the rug out from under us is this is exactly what you were afraid of. Right. We're going to give it to you. We're going to give it to you big by casting Peter Stormare and doing what he can do. And then it was like a big sigh of relief and a little chuckle when I realized, okay, we're done with him. We're going to get really to John Wick Chapter 2 now.
Yeah, you're way more forgiving than me. It just really, really bothered me. And I think the performance would have been something I could have forgiven, but it was then everything else. Again, comparing it without question.
The fight scene in that sequence, though, I think is quite good.
There are some really fascinating parts. I think we'll talk about what's good about this film without a doubt, but the performance there, the writing, everything about setting up that story, it felt like what so many sequels do really poorly, where it's trying to give us some new information. At the same time, it repeats so much of what we already know from the first movie, maybe as it's trying to bring new people in who haven't seen that film. So we even repeat the O moment that I singled out as my favorite from the original. Here, it's not that effective at all. We repeat all the Baba Yaga boogeyman stuff. It almost feels like we're getting the greatest hits of John Wick thrown into the first 2 minutes of the film, which maybe it's very self-aware. Maybe that's part of the joke. But we even later in the film get another, I'm thinking I'm back, just like we got so memorably in the first one. It just felt as if the filmmakers here felt like they had to hit certain notes, even down to, I joked in the setup about the pencil trick, which is this thing that keeps coming up. It comes up in the beginning of this film. We actually see him use the pencil trick later in the movie.
And which we know.
We
it's
never
always,
needed to see that.
Right, it's
that
always, was always better to hear.
Yes, what was so great about that story. And then everything about the character conversations that set up that movie. Again, my big thing about what I love about John Wick is the structure, the efficiency of it, and nothing about why he's there, really. Well, he's after his car, but nothing about how anybody else in that situation behaves and their explanation for it makes any sense at all. Even down to when we finally get John Wick, he comes into the room and he says to someone, I'm not that guy anymore. it's just after that. He's told someone he doesn't want to be part of this life. He's not that guy anymore. We just watched him destroy a garage full of people, just slaughter them. And he says, I'm not that guy anymore. It rings so hollow. It's just the script here is not doing this film any favors this time.
He was after his car, Adam, and that was the emotional loop that had not been closed from the first film.
I do love that.
Come on.
I do love that Mustang, but not as much as the dog, apparently.
Well, and the moment where he gets in, and this is gets back to Reeves' performance, too, where he gives us just enough, but maybe not always in the way we're expecting it or want it. The moment he slides behind the wheel, softly grabs it and just lets out a little sigh.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, that's all the emotion you need in this movie. Yes, the character motivation is far less compelling. It's no longer this extreme version of mourning or grieving that I talked about. So I will give you that. But it does have the little touches and attention to craft that I do think elevate both films. And even in that opening fight scene, after he has rammed his car, I did think, you know, why bother getting your car back when you're going to destroy
it? That's part of the joke there too, right? Totally destroyed.
In the first 2 minutes. So he rams his car into an adversary's car. That guy goes rolling out right next to his window, and they both stare at each other. And I don't know if directors or filmmakers who weren't so involved in stunt work would bother to do this. Just hold it for 2 seconds. So they look at each other, recognize that they've been hurt, recognize how ridiculous all of this is, and have a certain like elation that they're both somehow alive.
Yeah.
And then we move into more craziness.
The characters recognize the absurdity. The filmmakers recognize
it. But it's almost more than, I mean, it's just, it's not like a wink.
No.
You know, that I don't want to describe it as a wink. It's more of an attention to what is really going on in this scene for these two people. It happens with the way the soundtrack and the audio makes us hear each punch. You know, that's something that gets lost in other films because, again, to go back to that word we used earlier, chaos and mayhem and busyness, action busyness is mistaken for excitement. And here it's action precision. I think overall they still have that. Now, there is that sequence, another shootout kind of to mimic the much-loved club scene from the first film. There's one here that happens at a concert.
Yeah.
And
which feels totally redundant to me
again. It feels redundant, and there's a reason, is because it gets away from, there is an intimacy. It sounds ridiculous to say this, but there's an intimacy to that gun-fu style that the first film has, where they're using guns as cudgels, really, as much as firearms. And or they're shooting at close range. And once we've removed, he's further away from his victims. And you just, it just has that sort of callousness. Again, both of these movies are extremely callous.
Yes.
The number of people who die.
There is
so quickly. But there's something different in this film. And I think that crowd scene where he is just firing, not indiscriminately, but close, and certainly the other guys are, that's where I thought, okay, we've lost what made the first film special.
Yeah, I think there's unfortunately a lot of that with this film, but talking about things we praise, and in particular that style and the stunt work, the sequel does take to another level in a way that's legitimately impressive. The stunt work, the sense of these action sequences, for the most part, I think there are exceptions like the one you singled out, but there are a lot of sequences where it's almost a 3D experience. The camera is so close to the action. You can still see everything unfold, but then that motorcycle comes so close to the camera.
Oh, yeah.
You can't believe someone actually stood there for it. And as an audience member, you feel that. You feel like it's almost going to come off the screen and hit you, whether it's a motorcycle or it's a car door. It's unflinching in a way that can only be unflinching because of that attention to craft, because they clearly set out to make it as authentic as possible. I think the breakdown of those sequences could be really fascinating. For me, that without the story and the stakes is fun, but the pleasure is pretty fleeting, unfortunately. Where I do really appreciate the film, and this gets back to what you were saying about the movie not really winking at you. Well, here it's teetering right on that razor's edge again of winking and being self-aware. There's a great moment, and the movie, trying to appeal to us cinephiles out there, opens with a shot of Buster Keaton, a Buster Keaton film being projected on a wall. And other than it being kind of a clever moment where the visual from that movie matches the sound of what we hear coming at us.
It's a motorcycle,
It's a motorcycle, right?
In the Keaton film.
So it matches in a way that you can go, oh, that's really clever.
Yeah.
But where the Keaton reference to me really comes into play is after the big concert scene shootout, he's now engaged in a one-on-one battle with Common, who I think as a fellow hitman trying to do his job and trying to now kill John Wick is really good. And they get to a point, they're in Rome, and they come around a corner, and there's like two big flights of stairs.
I think there might be three.
There might be. And so this, for me, is that Buster Keaton moment where you always know with his big stunts, it's not about the surprise of the stunt. It's about the element almost of suspense. It's kind of like the Hitchcock thing. Knowing the bomb's going to go off is better than being shocked by it. And so you see those stairs, and the camera pauses there long enough to let you know, oh, they're going tumbling down these stairs. Like, they're there only to make sure they tumble down all three flights of those stairs. And so that element of absurdity and self-awareness is a real strength of this film. Again, I think they've taken something that was fundamental to the first film, and they've amped it up in the way you would expect a sequel to, but this is something that pays off, unlike so many of the other things about this that I think make it a poor sequel.
Let me give one other formally inventive moment that I did appreciate, and that was after, and there's some story ridiculousness tied to this too, but after a price has been put on his head,
mm-hmm.
and open call,
yes.
all hitmen, you know, go after John Wick, and he's back in New York,
yeah.
and he's walking down the street. Apparently, you know, 40% of the population, would you say,
are assassins.
So this is trouble for him. But the way they play with that is they decide to break up three different attacks
mm-hmm.
on him
yeah.
and merge them into one sequence.
Yeah.
So we're getting parallel cutting.
You're right. But it's non-linear. It's out of time.
No, it's got to be, mm-hmm. right? And so each fight scene is also proceeding at the same narrative, if that makes sense. So
right.
the climax of one scene, we cut to the climax of the other fight. And again, this flirts with parody too,
yeah.
but it's also really well constructed. And it's like we're in some sort of like a Wick multiverse where all of these fights are happening at the same time. That was kind of cool. I hadn't seen something like that before.
I thought that was cool. I also enjoyed as he's fighting with Common in this same sequence, there's a great little bit where they're both shooting at each other. One's elevated, one's not. And they're just
yes.
kind of sneakily trying to shoot each other, and no one else knows what's going on. The sequence with them before they even fight on the subway, just waiting to fight with each other. There's a lot of great suspense built into that. So there are some wonderful little flourishes here. But this, for me, Josh, is a case of a film. Again, like most sequels are, it's a whole lot slicker. There's a whole lot more production value,
yeah.
but so much less stylish overall for me. And I think that that's a case where, again, I will say visually, there's a certain style in all the things we're talking about that it's doing with the stunt work and the camera and the way the characters move. I'm speaking specifically here of the actual look of the film, the framing, the
yes,
color.
I would agree.
Those visual elements. It's no longer a graphic novel
no.
rendered on screen at all. It's now a Hollywood action movie in terms of its basic look.
The composition
yeah.
is not as careful. The running time is significantly longer. And I think both of those things mark it as a sequel,
yeah.
like the kind that you don't get as excited about.
Yeah, I saw a tweet from Jordan Ropp, who is a writer. I think he's the editor of thefilmstage.com. And he said, this is how you make a sequel. Expand the world in thrilling ways rather than rehashing the same experience of the original. And I imagine that as a director here, Chad Stahelski, and as the writer, Derek Kolstad back, that's exactly what they were trying to do. And in theory, Jordan is totally correct. Who wants a repeat experience of the original film? I think the trouble is when you stray too far from what made the other film so fundamentally good, that taut script and the structure and those clear character motivations. I think this movie tries to replace the imagination that we had to use, that we were allowed to use in the first film, with intricacy and kind of puffed up intrigue. It replaces story with plot, a whole lot of plot. It replaces character motivations with spectacle and set pieces. I think the plot here is totally contrived. And I don't mean contrived like unbelievable or absurd, because it's all both of those things, but full of maneuverings that feel false and a bunch of deal making and added rules that really suck the life out of this movie. And it becomes at one point a James Bond film. Where
yes,
why is John Wick going to Rome?
James Bond.
And,
yes,
and he's looking
true.
At cool weapons like he's in a scene with Q, and he's going to the tailor. There's a certain element of fun in those scenes, don't get me wrong. I even love the faces that inhabit those scenes, the supporting players who appear only in those sequences. But there's that contrivance, there's that unnecessary complication. And then I know, I shouldn't nitpick, but how about in that sequence, the one that launches the big shootout and Common at the concert, he's going to fulfill his assignment. Somehow John Wick is able to be this ninja boogeyman. Nobody sees or hear him. Nothing. But when the plot needs someone to see him so it can ignite that gigantic chase and shootout, of course, he runs into Common.
He's
just walking out of the party and gets spotted by the one guy he shouldn't run into. It's dumb, and I think, although it is pretty fun, half of it, as we said, is redundant. It feels like it's staged very similarly to the nightclub scene from the first movie. And even the end of the film, without spoiling anything, I'll say that there's a big showdown involving a hall of mirrors. How many films, how many action films have we seen do that same hall of mirrors, don't know where the bad guy is, shoot a bunch of glass thing? Lots of them have done it. I don't know that there was enough of a new wrinkle here to transcend it. But at the end of it, Josh, what it boils down to is, despite the things I could appreciate about it, despite some of these things that maybe I thought were redundant, it all didn't matter because I shouldn't be bored watching a John Wick movie, and I was bored because of all that plot maneuvering. That lack of structure just really soured me on it.
I don't think the Hall of Mirrors climax reinvents the wheel by any means for that sort of setting, but I do think it plays a little bit more, or at least allows for that sense of intimacy I was talking about to come back into it,
right,
where he is actually being forced to fully face in multiple ways his victims and himself. And when he does come face to face with one character who's been pursuing him throughout the film but never really fully engaged, and they engage finally, I think that setting helps to make that confrontation a little more interesting. I will say too, speaking to the Bond thing, however, though, and this goes back to what I was saying about what does it matter to call this film callous? They're both callous. I would say this film also, you know, has a gun fetish in a way
more than the first
that
one.
The first one doesn't. That was a little bit kind of icky as well. So these are things that maybe it's just inevitable for a sequel that gets bigger and gets blown up to more. That is always going to be a problem when one of the greatest virtues of the original was being streamlined.
Yes.
Maybe someday someone will make a sequel that's smaller, quicker, faster and lighter than the first film. I don't know that I've seen it yet.
Yeah, I feel like there's maybe been one or two that have managed to pull that trick off, but I'm drawing a blank, and I'd love to hear from any listeners who can think of an example. But the first movie also did something well, Josh, which was hint at deeper philosophical themes without ever remotely trying to hit us over the head with it or make us believe that that's what the movie was really about, but suggesting that he's a character who obviously is always drawn back to this type of life and might be damned in some way for it. We get some visuals at the end of John Wick, the first one, where it looks like he's in a hellscape, right? And we see the flames and those kind of things.
Yeah, here they ask him about
it. Here they blatantly talk about, being damned to hell. And I just think that that's one of those elements where the movie, again, is lacking that imagination and that drive to make us use our imagination. It wants to spell all of those things out. But that sequence you mentioned in New York City, that's one of the inspired bits of the movie, but in a way, a very blatant homage to the Walter Hill film, The Warriors, which I'm a big fan of that movie, so I appreciated it. But that's a movie that's all about this gang, of course, trying to get home in New York City, down to the fact that a lot of it takes place in subway stations. Mm-hmm. They're constantly seeking refuge and they're being attacked in these places by all the other gangs that are out to get them. So I like that touch, whether it was blatantly an homage or not, on the part of Stahelski and Derek Kolstad. I thought that did work. And those little surprises that you get that suggest this larger network, that was fascinating. But when the movie spends so much time showing us how big that network is, that's when I just started to lose interest a little bit in John Wick Chapter 2. It is out now in theaters everywhere. And this is one we split on a little bit, and I know that there are some really rapturous reactions to the film out there, so I'm sure we're going to hear from a few listeners in response. I look forward to those responses.
Well, and you're one example, but I can't imagine many people who are huge fans of the original are severely down on this.
Yeah.
But maybe there are others.
Just don't watch it right before you go
maybe
into
that
this
was
film,
it.
And you'll be fine. That is our show. In addition to reaching us via email, you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at FilmSpotting. Josh is at Larson on Film. At our website, filmspotting.net, that's where you can find, we're approaching it, 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, please do vote in the current Film Spotting poll, which Pantheon/Sacred Cow movie couple will be the Cinderella of this year's Film Spotting Madness. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Brand new SVU this week. They're looking at Swiss Army Man.
Indeed. Out in limited release, A United Kingdom. This is a film about a prince of Botswana who causes an international stir when he marries a white woman from London. It takes place in the late 40s. David Oyelowo and Rosamund Pike star in that film. Starless Dreams, a new documentary from Iran, and Unbroken Glass. This is a new documentary from our friends here in Chicago, Kartemquin, of course, the makers of Hoop Dreams, The Trials of Muhammad Ali, and The Interrupters. It comes to the Gene Siskel Film Center at the Art Institute of Chicago this weekend, runs through the 23rd for its first theatrical run. It's a movie about a filmmaker, Dinesh Sabu, and his journey to understand his parents, who died 20 years ago when he was 6 years old. He travels the world and pieces together the story of his mother's schizophrenia and how his family dealt with it in an age and culture where mental illness was often misunderstood. It sounds fascinating. Their work always is. We encourage you to seek out the latest from Kartemquin. Out in wide release, A Cure for Wellness, the new film from Gore Verbinski. Josh, you're curious about this one. Are you going to see it?
Yeah, I'm a Gore Verbinski fan, and it has the recommendation. Would you call this a recommendation? Here's
even,
David Ehrlich.
Gore Verbinski's mother doesn't say, I'm a Gore Verbinski fan.
Oh, come on.
All I can think of is those terrible Pirates movies. I'm sorry. What are you a fan
the
of?
The Weatherman.
I haven't seen
and
it.
And the Pirates movies I like.
Which ones?
Yeah, I think
which
I one? Like, how many
the
are
first
there?
One
are there
good.
14?
Yeah, there's
okay,
14.
I'm in for,
one
I think I'm in
good.
For like three.
No way.
I'm not a fan of the Lone Ranger. I will say that.
Okay.
So I'm rooting for him to make up for that. David Ehrlich called A Cure for Wellness a sick film for sick people. Gore Verbinski's A Cure for Wellness is the strangest movie that a major studio has released since 2014's Inherent Vice.
Yeah, I don't think
he's now
recommending
you're in.
It, though.
Now no. you're in.
I'm not.
I'll see it.
Fist Fight is also out with Ice Cube and Charlie Day. It was very fun watching the trailer for this movie, the Red Band trailer, the incredibly vulgar, explicit Red Band trailer for this before John Wick Chapter 2 with your father sitting in between us.
That's right.
That was an experience. I'm glad he's such
understand.
An enlightened man.
What are they fighting about in that movie? Could you tell from that trailer?
Charlie Day, like, throws him under the bus and says he did something wrong, I guess.
Okay, thanks.
I think that's it.
That was helpful.
The Great Wall is out. We also saw part of the trailer for this as we walked in from Zhang Yimou. Hero, House of the Flying Daggers. It stars Matt Damon. I'm just going to say it because I can't stop myself every time it comes on TV or I see it in a theater. I think it looks like the worst movie ever made.
That might be a little extreme. I will say it has awfully fuzzy CGI.
Oh, it's bad. It's just
awfully
everything
fuzzy.
About it. I will not see this movie. I don't care if it starts
to get
John Wick, like, favorable reviews. I'm not going.
Does Matt Damon have a ponytail in it, or was that just the fuzzy CGI? I couldn't quite tell.
You will have to go and answer that question. Next
I'll be
week.
At A Cure for Wellness.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Next week on the show, our Oscar picks, and we get back to Buñuel. We wrap up the Luis Buñuel marathon with his final feature, 1977's That Obscure Object of Desire, plus our Buñuel Awards, Best Picture, Best Moment, Best Performance. Sam, doing his fine work as a producer, he's thrown out a few titles here. Josh, these are pretty good, tying in with Buñuel, some of the words that have come up over and over again, The Scoundrels, The mm-hmm. Hypocrites, The Eyeball, going back to probably his most memorable and infamous image.
Mm-hmm.
The Obscure Objects of Desire is hard to beat.
Yeah,
that.
I was going to say.
It's unwieldy, but it's great.
I kind of like that one, too.
If you have any thoughts on Buñuel or the Oscars, pick a category. Leave us a short voicemail about who will win or who should win, and we may use it in next week's show. You can leave us a voicemail at 312-264-0744.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you enjoyed the show, help us spread the word. You can do that by giving us a rating or a review on iTunes. That's a great way for us to reach new listeners. Our music this week comes from Molly's Tenarowin. It's from the new album Elwan. More information is at tenarowin.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Painful 16% on the tomato meter. Is that tomato meter? That sounds so weird.
I don't think I've ever said it out loud, tomato but I believe
meter.
That's right.
It just sounds, both times I've said it, it sounds
Thermometer.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.